once I had made my first dollar in this space, this is what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
We're on a mission. We're going to find and uncover the smartest, most successful entrepreneurs on the planet, explore their highs, their lows, and how they ultimately mastered the game. I'm Martin Cook, and I'm excited to welcome you to the Smarter Destiny podcast. I'm grateful for you and your time. Now let's level up together. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another expert interview. And today, frankly, this introduction is going to be a little bit overwhelming because we have a true legend of the digital space in our midst. Mr. Jason Akatiff is a phenomenal guy. Like, where do we start? Where do we start? Is it the keynote speaking for Affiliate Summit? Is it the dominating the affiliate world? Is it the launching of an affiliate platform by accident and then growing to be one of the largest ones in the US? Is it having warehouses across the world, creating his own products, teaching from stage, generally doing whatever it is he wants because that's the lifestyle he's built? I'm not sure which one of those highlights are for you, but it's tremendously exciting. And so I think it's important that I keep this introduction as short as possible to maximize the amount of time we have in this interview to delve into his story. So without further ado, Jason, how are you?
I'm doing great today. It's early morning over here in San Diego, shooting this from my home office, and just excited to be on with you.
Fantastic. And of course, the reason that we are together today is because you, of course, are attending our amazing mastermind event in Koh Samui, which, shout out to the other speakers at helping me pronounce that properly because I still mess it up. And so, of course, we're going to delve into that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, sounds I'm excited good. To come over there.
Fantastic. And so, you know the drill by now, the listeners, you know the drill by now that we're going to find a starting point and then we're going to just, you know, cruise through the story and the whys behind the decisions that Jason's made that have led him to where he is today. And so, Jason, really, can you think of a logical starting point for us, a logical starting point of where your entrepreneur journey kind of began to blossom? And if so, can you paint us a word picture and tell us where and when we are?
Yeah, I mean, I thank you so much for the intro, Martin. And, I'm just, my entrepreneurial journey actually started when I was a kid. My family was all entrepreneurs, and so I always wanted to be an entrepreneur in my life, but didn't necessarily know how to do it. And, you know, it's always interesting that journey that you go through and, that process. But, the main point of jumping off into this business, into the digital space, I was selling franchise licenses for people that wanted to open Blimpy sub sandwich chains, and they were going to go out of business, or they were like right on the border. They are still around, and they ended up laying me off. I was doing sales for them, and I bought an ebook that came with some Perl scripts and a forum, and I think I paid $35 for it back in 2003, I believe. It was one of those things where, right now we always see you can make money on the internet and there's all this information out there. And, I had bought that and I was like, I heard about this internet thing. People are making money on the internet, so I'm going to learn about it. And that was kind of my initial investment there. I probably made my $35 back from that book I bought. I don't really ever think I made much more than that, but one really, really powerful thing that I learned very early on was the book was whatever, the scripts were whatever, but the forum and the community that was in that forum was really what motivated me to be to push forward. Right? Had I just bought a book, read it, tried it out, didn't work, I probably would have quit. But I became really engaged in the community and the group of individuals there. There was people seeing success, and that kept me super motivated. It also just I started to build relationships and started to network with people, which honestly still to this day, one of the main reasons I'm going to Koh Samui is that, I know there's going to be a great quality of people there, and I'm excited to meet some high level like-minded people in the space. So.
So what amazing transition. So you went from on the brink of being laid off from your job selling the franchises to taking a punt on an ebook plus forum membership, which is a slightly unusual package, frankly. That's quite an unusual bundle.
Well, actually, the forum was free. You know, forums were relatively always free until Stack That Money came along, and they kind of changed the dynamic of that, obviously. But you got the ebook, and then you got, you know, just to be part of this forum, right? And then, you know, ultimately, I didn't make any money for about 13 months in the space. I spent 17 hours a day, 7 days a week, chasing this dream, and I still have my tax return. Every once in a while, I'll post a picture of it that I made $26,000 in that year. I worked harder than I ever had in my whole life, probably by two or three times. And the only money I made was from unemployment and Social Security here in the United States over that period of time. But then, kind of on that month 13, I had met a guy. He was having some success. He shared what he was doing with me, and I think I made about $100,000, $120,000 in that 13th month. All in the same month, which, you know, made all that trudging through the mud and all that hard work and all that stuff, you know, well worth it in the end. But, you know, it always reminds me of that picture that we've all seen with the miner, you know, and he's right near the diamonds and he's like giving up. And for me, I that was once I had made my first dollar in this space, this is what I was going to do for the rest of my life. Cause I was like, this is great. I don't have to talk to anybody. I can sit at home and work on my computer, and make money. And I was like, this is a dream. And, you know, that's really where I put my time in.
Phenomenal. And and absolutely the analogy with the miner coming in and just giving up just before he hits the diamonds, or the
right.
or the people that build those 90% finished bridges, or, you know, the people driving their car and turning off just before, you know, thinking that they've passed their destination just before they get to, all of that stuff's a great analogy for where entrepreneurship often leads to. And so at that time, in that 13th month, what sort of making money online thing were you doing?
Back then it was so it was all SEO. So I was doing what was called black hat SEO. So essentially you'd figure out how Google or Bing, what was then Microsoft Search Engine, or I forget, I don't even remember the name of it right now. You'd figure out how the algorithms would work. And what we figured out was, you know, just no matter the quantity of backlinks or links from other sites you could get to your site, really made a difference on your rankings. So then we found out that you could leave a comment on somebody's blog, and blogs were brand new at the time, with a link in it that pointed back to your site. And the guy that taught me how to do it, we kind of split stuff up. He took mortgage, I took payday loans, I took some insurances, he took some insurances. So then we kind of worked in tandem in order to, you know, so we didn't compete against one another. And, you know, that's really where I made my first initial batch of money in this space. Things were a lot different at the time, like ranking in the search engines and stuff like that. Stuff's progressed greatly. It's gotten much harder to do those things. But back in those days, you know, and keep in mind, this is always my favorite. People are like, well, it used to be easier. And, you know, back then in 2003, you used to just put keywords in your page in probably 99 through 2003. You didn't even need backlinks. So it's just how many times you could stuff the keyword in the page was how you ranked number one. And if somebody had a million keywords in the page of the same keyword, it would rank the most. So all those guys at that point in time were like, wow, this is hard. You got to get links now in this. It used to be so easy. And it's always interesting to watch as the industry progresses. Everybody always looks back and goes, it used to be so easy. And, you know, right now, what I think is interesting is, you know, we're going to look back in 5 years from now and go, today is easy. You know, five years from now, this is going to be the easiest point in time, you know, to make stuff happen. And we often lose sight of that. And, you know, if you look in the rearview mirror all the time, you know, you probably are going to lose sight of where you're going in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, as you said, like, so many people like now are thinking of talking about how easy email marketing was, or like how easy it used to be, like you said, to stuff the keywords and you would just make the color of the font the same color as the background, so they're invisible.
Sure.
All that stuff. But you know, that's how the world transitions on, right? And so,
right.
So you were doing this, and I think the internet went a bit choppy, but so I think what you said was you created a software that automatically found these sites and posted your backlink on them many, many times a day. Did you say 1,000 a thousand a day or something? What did you say?
500,000.
500,000.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, that's pretty powerful. I mean,
through that year of not making money, I had taught myself to code in PHP and build automated stuff and manage servers and everything that we need to do as affiliates in order to be successful. You know, I've always had a premise of, you know, I'm a big fan of Jim Rohn, who was Tony Robbins' mentor, and he always said, you know, work harder on yourself than you do in your business. So, you know, that's always been a principle that I've operated from as far as in my life. So, you know, through that period of time, I learned to manage servers, I learned to code, I learned to design, I learned to write copy, I learned to do all that stuff. It didn't actually manifest into money directly in that short period of time, but you know, it was all that investment that paid dividends on that 13th month, because the guy came to me and he was manually posting these links, and I was like, oh well, I can build us an automated system that'll do it, and you know, go out and find the places to post and then post. And you know, he was like, well, that's cool, I'll show you how to do everything I know how to do if you can write that system and share it with me. And so really it was because I had done that work on that front end, and I could bring that tool chest to the table, that, you know, he even wanted to be a part of sharing that, you know, inside information with me.
And you'd met him through the connectivity that the forum had provided. Yep. You.
Exactly.
And yeah. So how did that transition? So, you know, so you're creating these highly ranked sites through the backlinks and so on. How did that transition?
So that progressed. I did stuff in, you know, ranking and whatnot for about 4.5 years. You know, and I progressed through some different forums. There was one called Blog to Rank, and then there was another one called Syndicate with an 8 on the end, and then eventually I found Wicked Fire, which at that point of time was the biggest, fastest growing forum on the internet for affiliate marketing. I think they had 100,000 plus members. It was huge, really, really big, really active. And then I met some other people, but you know, part of my process, I like strategy a lot, so I like to figure out how stuff works and understand how to exploit or optimize for it. So then I started to partner with what I called project partners at the time. And these were all individual relationships. And I'd do 50-50 deals with somebody. And I'd bring the resources and I'd bring the ideas and I'd do the business development and collect the money and make sure all that side of it was handled. And then they'd actually, you know, write the code and manage the code. And then I wound up with 7 of these project partners. And then I worked with, I think, 3 or 4 affiliate networks at the time. So then I had 7 times 4 accounts to manage. And I was like, well, this is a pain in the butt. So I wound up buying the network, which was called Adsferdo. It was founded by a friend of mine. You know, I was like, oh, well, I'll just get this platform and then I can manage my people. And it's already got some of the merchant relationships and whatnot. So I bought Adsferdo for $20,000 back in 2008. And at that time, I'd been contributing to Wicked Fire for probably 4 or 5 years at that point. Well, maybe not that long, maybe 3 years. Probably had 3,000 posts in there. And, you know, my theory has always just been help as many people as you can, and you know, based on what I know, give information freely, help as many people as I can. Like I come from a very abundance based mindset. I'm not like, oh, if I share this is my golden goose and I'm never going to have it. Like it just is what it is. So I've always tried to help other people be successful and share freely. And, you know, just by doing that, you know, some people had found out that I had a network platform, which was a very different landscape back in 2008. You know, now there's probably 20 different network platform providers and this, like, there was one. It was called Direct Track back in the day, and it was pretty expensive to get. And so there was no networks. I mean, there was a handful of big networks, but there wasn't, you know, hundreds or thousands of these little networks out there. So, you know, some people had found out, and then, once that happened, I had about 2,000 affiliates sign up from Wicked Fire the next day. And all of a sudden I was in a network business, which I never really intended to start. So then,
A4D became an affiliate network with like 2,000 affiliates in that network, just from the relationships you'd built from giving value in Wicked Fire.
Correct. Yeah, and it was literally me at my house. I had no employees. I had no nothing. I was doing the business development. I was doing the affiliate management. I was doing the setting up the offers. I was doing the contracts. I was collecting the money. I did the account. I did everything. And it grew so fast that I had to hire fairly quickly. In the early days, I got connected with a guy out of San Francisco, and he introduced me to the Nutra free trial space back in 2008. Which, was acai and colon cleanse back in the day, which everybody's familiar with all the FTC stuff that went down with that. But all of a sudden we started doing 10,000 trials a day. I'm in the network business for 3 months and I'm doing 10,000 trials a day, and which is just insane amounts of volume. And then the company just kind of exploded from there. Good. And then it exploded more times badly down the road, but
we'll get to that in a second. So when you say free trial, those are the landing pages where it's like a couple of bucks to get a trial, and then the credit card automatically gets rebilled like $100 and something a short time later, right?
Exactly.
And so
right,
10,000 trials a day, probably there wasn't a huge amount of people canceling those trials because it was difficult.
There was a lot of people. We got paid on a CPA though, right? So we worked with third party vendors. They paid us, I believe, $35 at the time for each sign up. Mm. So, you know, we were doing some pretty substantial volume pretty quickly. And it was all with trusted affiliates that I had known, you know, from the Wicked Fire days. And, you know, one thing we've always had on that's been great on the A4D side is, you know, just the affiliates that we've worked with, you know, we have a real strong understanding of, you know, how media buying works. So it's very hard to do fraud against our network because, you know, there's just such a deep understanding of everything and how it all works. So it's been lucky for that.
And so, you're living the high life, right? You're in real life stacking money. You're converting 10,000 odd trials a day at a $30-$35 CPA. You've found the golden goose. You must be cloud nine, absolutely loving life. Then you retired and bought a castle, right? Is that the next point of the story?
That's what happened. I stopped working. Started helping the homeless and the poor, and you know, it just went off on a private jet. No, of course not. this is business. It never stays the way it is today. It changes all the time, and you know, you learn a lot of hard lessons, and you make a lot of mistakes, and you make a lot of failures through that process. So. Yeah, I mean, we grew really quickly. I'm not going to get into hiring the first employee and stuff like that, but we grew very quickly. And, you know, in the beginning, we were brokering all of our deals through a couple of other affiliate networks. So we were actually just a rebroker of another affiliate network. And those affiliate networks always paid us very religiously on time. They made sure we were paid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm like, oh, wow. Look at all this margin we're giving to this other affiliate network. Let's go find our own direct merchants. And so then we started to do that. In the short term, it looked a lot better for us. We're like, oh, look, we're making more margin. This is awesome. And then about 2010, I didn't get paid $4 million in payments and payables due to the banks changing how stuff worked and holding accounts and freezing funds, which happens in that space, which I learned the hard way. I didn't know anything about. And so at that time, we had about $150,000 a month in overhead. I had about $100,000 left in the bank, and I had to turn off all these merchants that I was working with because they weren't paying their bills. And that was probably one of the harder points in my life where I'm like, what are we going to do? How am I going to pay all these people? They're all great people. I want to keep them on the team, love working with them. And then we somehow tripped and fell and found auto insurance, and auto insurance was what had saved the day. There was actually a company called To Insure for Less, and To Insure for Less was actually selling. So they were basically taking all leads and with no caps. And, you know, we were doing 14,000 auto insurance leads a day to Insure for Less. And that's really what saved the company at that point in time. I still work with some of the people on the affiliate side that were instrumental in helping that, helping the company survive through that process. So, you know, we did that, and then we started to kind of dip our toe back into, back into the trial space, because it did make so much money, but with much tighter credit, you know, type situation, you know, either daily payments, prepayments, or very, very short term payments with those merchants, and then continued to grow that business until about 2012.
And so what happened in 2012?
One thing, you know, just going back to 2003, you know, like, you start in this business and you're just like, all you're trying to do is just make some money, right? It's like, oh, if I could just replace my job and make some money, and then you start making some money and then whatever. And you don't ever think about legal compliance, really. You know, that's one drum that I beat quite a bit in this space when I give my talks is, you know, you really got to be cognizant of compliance and, you know, legal compliance. And, you know, we were doing these free trials, and I kind of had an inkling like, I don't know if this is okay. I don't know how to feel about this. You know, you start making a bunch of money and you're like, and they did a sweep in the space. So you've got in the affiliate network space, you've got your affiliates that buy all the traffic, create the creatives, build the pages, landing pages and stuff like that. Then you've got your merchants that are the ones that actually ship the product, build the customer, whatever. And then we're the network that kind of sits in the middle and connects the two parts. Well, they did a sweep. They sued 12 affiliates, 12 of the larger affiliates. Then they sued about 12 of the merchants, and then they did a sweep of the network. So ClickBooth, us, Copiac, there's a handful of other ones. They came through and swept. Now we'd done probably to that point in time $400 million or so in revenue in that world, and we ended up paying $1 million fine to the FTC, which, you know, a lot of the people on the other two sides, they got wiped out. Like, literally, they took everything that they had. You know, for us, you know, we were kind of in the middle. We didn't build the creatives. We didn't own the customers. We were just kind of, the click went through us, and we tracked the money and paid the person. So we weren't really doing anything wrong ourselves, but FTC has this thing called ill-gotten gains, where they're like, hey, you made money from this, you need to be fined. So we paid them $1 million wire on that deal. We also signed an order with them that says we can't do anything in the weight loss space without two double-blind studies to back a weight loss product. So, you know, at that point in time, this case went on for 2.5 years. And it was dragging on and dragging on. And in 2012, I was like, well, you know, and they actually, the FTC in those 2 years, they never said if they were going to sue us or not. They were just doing, they just had a subpoena and were doing an investigation. So I literally still had no idea for 2 years whether we were going to get sued or we were just part of an investigation. And then in 2012, I called my attorneys and I said, well, we're going to go full court press on the FTC, because if they're going to take everything, I want them to take it right now. So I can start over. I don't want to keep going down this road for another year or 2 years, amassing, you know, assets and money and whatever. And, you know, then have them come take it at that point and have to start over 2 years from now. I want to start over right now. So I made my attorneys get on the phone and force the FTC's hand to tell us what they were going to do. And that's at the point of time where they said, yes, we are going to sue you. We actually did all the negotiations with the FTC, and we settled. They sued us and settled in the same day. So if you go look at it's all public information if you go look. So it was a fairly amicable process with them. But at this point in time, I was in Greece for 3 weeks with my wife. So when we settled, I basically told everybody, we got to turn off all the trial stuff. We're getting out of that business. And then I came back, and our overhead in the company for, you know, buildings and employees and stuff like that was about $17,000 a day. When I came back with all that other stuff turned off, we were making about $3,000 a day. So I remember I used to visualize walking into the office every day, laying $14,000 on the front desk, and then going to work for 10 hours, because that was reality, right? I got to pay $14,000 to come to work for 10 hours.
Yeah. What a treat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I imagine that was, I mean, first of all, I can see the sort of looking over your shoulder type thing for 2 years, and it's almost like, congratulations, you got an answer and got sued, because like, that's so much better than, right, the waiting, like, surely, right, you know, your inbox would be a really scary pressing that refresh button to see if the email came in or the letter on your doorstep or so on, so, sure. You know, congratulations. But then obviously turning off what sounds like the main breadwinner, right, for A for D at that point. You know, now it's created this new fire for you to put out the 17 grand a day overhead thing, which is significant, right? So How did you get past that and then move on to the next thing?
You go through a whole gambit of emotions when stuff like this happens, and you know, if you're, I'm a fairly introspective person, so I look inwards a lot and spend time, you know, trying to figure out, you know, kind of what are the next steps. I don't move too quickly in any one direction. I like to say I just sit in the shit for a while and kind of see what manifests, you know, do what I do and see what, just like sometimes something like this happens and people are like, okay, I need to run really, really fast in a direction to get something going again. And sometimes the best thing you can do is just do nothing, right? And just spend time with your thoughts and say, okay, well, so part of going through that process for me was, I thought about selling A4D. I was like, well, you know, maybe I could sell this company. And this was a real pivotal point in my life where, you know, I had just done stuff to make money up until this point in time. And, you know, I looked at selling A4D, and really, after doing a little analysis and a little soul searching, you know, A4D was worth nothing. You know, maybe a brand, maybe I could sell it for 20 grand for the brand and the names and the list, right? Mm-hmm. But there had been no real value created inside of the company. It had created some cash and some money. There was really no value created inside of the organization from systems and processes, from repeatability, scalability, none of that stuff, right? And it had lived in a space that was ultimately not sellable, right? No private equity or venture capital or anything like that wants anything to do with the free trial, you know, Nutra space. They just don't. It's too problematic. So, you know, at this point in my life is kind of where I changed my vision to, okay, well, anything I do moving forward, I wanted to create intrinsic value inside of the company while building cash flow as well. And that's really been a core principle I've operated my life from that point on. So kind of everything I looked at from that point on, I was like, well, am I creating core value inside the organization, you know, by going down this road or making this decision? In 2012, this is a hard thing, right? So, you know, I had all these employees that were specialists at the Nutra-free trial space. You know, us going down and a couple of other networks going down, that created 10 other networks. You know, took all the crumbs that we left and then went on. So a lot of the employees left on their own. I didn't really have to let people go. They weren't capable of figuring out another space, and you know, they were just used to doing that thing. And that's the interesting thing about a lot of employees. They just want to do the same thing every day and oftentimes don't want to grow or learn that much. And so there's a lot of people that left the company to go do the same thing. You know, we ultimately got the overhead down to about 7,000 a day from 17. And then, from there, you know, we got the revenue or the margin up to 7,000 a day. And kind of that was, we got it to a break even point, you know, with some lead gen stuff. And at that point, you know, one of my favorite things to do is, we have a house in Lake Tahoe. So I went up to Lake Tahoe and I love to just open Word and Excel, turn off the internet, and then just spend anywhere from 2 days to 4 days just with your thoughts. And, you know, I really started to journal down like where I thought the opportunity was. You'd do an analysis on what assets we have as far as the people, as far as the relationships, as far as the knowledge and the systems and whatever we did have. And at that point in time, I really made a decision to go forward, and we ended up going pretty heavily into lead generation. We built a lot of our own portals for personal loans and bankruptcy lead gen, refi, and yada yada yada. And we were pretty heavy into lead gen for a number of years after that. And that was really the focus in A4D from probably 2012 to 2014 or 2015.
Okay.
You know, the guy started to grow.
And so that was the pivot, and I love the wisdom that comes from that. Going back to what you said, because it's so important. Yeah, that feels that need, that desire sometimes to just run really fast, and you know, you bring that analogy into the real world, right? You go, I've got a problem, I've got to work fast, right? Well, say let's talk about it as current location and destination you want to get to, right? That destination right. Could be due north, the correct destination. But if you correct. Run really fast and your compass is off, you could be sprinting in the direction of south, right? Like right. further away from it. And so that wisdom to be able to go, do you know what? What's 4 days? If I'm trying to figure out what I want to do for the next 5 years, right. what's 4 days to right. To do that? But I'm curious. I get the journaling thing, and you know, I have this. Sexy looking leather bound, it looks like a treasure map type thing,
right?
But Excel, how does that work in the process?
I love business models, so typically I'll journal down, or I'll be like, okay, here's what we've got. We've got this, we've got this, we've got this, and then really take a look at the space, different verticals or areas that we could focus our attention on, write down all the good and the bad, kind of, you know, what's everything good and bad about this space? Where do we run into roadblocks? How does it scale? Yada, yada, yada. And then you make a decision. Okay, we want to go down this road. Okay, well, what does that business model look like? That's the immediate next thing that I have to go to that says, what do I think, you know, in our business, what do I think an affiliate manager could manage in this space versus that old space? What do I think of business development? What kind of lead caps would we need? What do we think of quality as a ratio of a percentage? So my mind immediately goes to Excel and building a business model, because I always operate off of a business model. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's really important. And no matter what business you're in, you forecast out what you think it's going to look like, and you're 99% of the time going to be wrong. But then you can go back to that model and say, okay, well, where was I wrong? Okay, I was wrong here, here, and here. I thought this was going to work this way, or this would hit this number or whatnot, and that didn't happen. So let's make a course correction and let's make a new forecast. And you're always working a plan, and that plan, you know, is around a business model.
Nice.
So
yeah. Makes perfect sense. And I do the same thing, but I remember mentors a number of years ago drumming it into me and it being such a pain. You're like, do one. I don't want to. You know, they're like, you know, do the numbers, do the financial forecast kind of thing. You're like, ah, I just want to do the business. I don't want to do. But, it, you know, like you say, it's so important. I'm doing numbers for business models and so on. I'm excited about how you were able to do it without any internet to research. Like, that's another level of planning. So
I was already mildly doing the businesses, right? Like,
yeah.
We've been in lead gen, we've been in financial newsletters, we did a lot in the language learning space. So I had data that, you know, we had been doing stuff, but, you know, a lot of times I find people, you know, they're like, okay, well, this thing is making me money, so this is what I'm going to do. And there's so many things, you know, when you get to a certain point in your career, there's so many things that you could do to make money. And a lot of the process is, okay, in 2 years from now, where am I going to run into a roadblock? How is this thing going to scale? And ultimately, we still do a lot of lead gen on the network side of the business, but it's not really who we are as a company. For a while, it was like we were building our own portals, we were doing this and this, we were headed. And I ultimately, there was something that I didn't see, and I wanted to build a multi-billion-dollar company. And, you know, as I looked in the space, I was like, well, you know, I did this in hindsight. So this is something that I've learned over the years. You know, the biggest company I knew in the space was doing $300 million a year in revenue, and they had to own a sales floor of 1,200 sales reps in order to do that revenue. And ultimately, I decided I didn't want to own a 1,200-person sales floor. So at that point, we really started to back off on the lead gen side of the business, you know, building our own lead gen. We still do a ton for third party, but building our own stuff, because I was like, this isn't going to get me to where I want to go. But we were 2 years down the road of that process. And, you know, I really want to inspire everybody else to say, you know, where are my roadblocks going to come in, and who are we going to have to become as a company? And do I want to do that thing? Because I did not want to have 1,200 sales reps. Like, that just was, you know, call center and 1,200 sales reps was not something I wanted to do. And ultimately, had I seen that 2 years earlier, I probably wouldn't have gone down that road. So as I've gotten older and wiser, I spend more and more and more time researching and analyzing what I should be doing, and don't just do things because they're in front of me.
And that's super interesting as well, because a lot of people go, well, it's a, you know, a $24 billion industry, you know, and so I could, you know, I could grow it to at least a billion, but don't necessarily go one step further. So there, a lot of people would stop. Yeah. Tick in the box, like, check. But actually then saying, well, you know, what do the businesses in this space who are making $1 billion, what do they have in terms of infrastructure and costs and moving parts and, you know, wheels that need to turn and departments and then sort of going, well, is it still a check in the box if you need 1,200 people, like a sales force of 1,200 right. people, right? That's a lot of mouths to sure. feed, particularly when yeah. you've just come from a 17, you know, 17 grand a day, you know, mouth to feed type overhead issue before, right? So,
I wouldn't mind 1,200 people, right? But 1,200 knowledge workers, telemarketers, and logistics people, like, that I'm into. I just didn't want 1,200 sales reps.
Like, you don't want to become Wolf of Wall Street.
Right. Yeah. That just was not something I wanted to do.
Fair enough. And so so you transitioned from the free trials into lead gen, and then but then you wanted to build a multi-billion-dollar company, realized that the infrastructure, well, first of all, you'd have to be like four times bigger than the biggest, and the infrastructure you would need for that wasn't your idea of fun.
Right.
And so what did you then decide to do?
Well, I mean, from a vertical standpoint, we got into what's called VSLs, or long form video sales letter type products, and we did that quite a bit in the finance and language learning space. But that wasn't really another space I wanted to be in. So I don't remember when it was. It was I want to say 2015. I put myself through a process. I can talk about it more at another time, but I put myself through a process that says, what do I want my life to look like? And without the specificity of business, without the specificity of any of that, it was like, I want to build a multi-billion dollar company. I want to vacation 120 days a year. I want to have 10 amazing people report to me directly that I learn from every day. I went through this laundry list of almost 30 items that kind of described in an abstract sense of what I wanted my life to look like. And ultimately, once I had built that, then I started to look for a business to get into that ticked most of those boxes. And you know, that's when I ran into e-commerce. And at that time, of course, drop shipping was starting to take off. You know, I was talking to a lot of people in the drop shipping space, and you know, that I looked at that business, and that business, the drop shipping business itself, didn't meet the requirements. But I was like, well, if I could build my own products and my own brands, then that does tick the boxes. Because on one of those boxes was, I want to see my products in Target or Walmart or something when I walk in. I want to be able to walk over to a shelf and see my brands and my products on that shelf. That's just, you know, some people want to go on vacation for bucket lists. That was a bucket list thing for me. So, you know, I kind of took the drop shipping business and said, okay, we'll go find products and then start to build our own brands and products around those, and product iterations around those products that are working for us through the initial model. And about 3.5 years ago is when I went on that adventure and started building our e-commerce product company. I really think of it more of a product company than an e-commerce company. And it's really the goal with that is we've built technology and teams in order to facilitate the rapid, development of consumer brands in a profitable fashion.
And so it sounds to me like, I'm getting a hunch, shall we say, that you looked at the dropshipping model and went, this is really cool, but it's got some flaws.
Yes.
And so how can I evolve it to meet my checklist, which, by the way, I would love to see your checklist. I know it's your checklist, but I'd still love to see that checklist. Because it sounded really cool, like the vacationing 120 days a year. I mean, you had me sold. I was sold at that. And then $1 billion, I think, was the next one. So, yeah, tick.
And by the way, you know, it's just how, as you look at everything and every decision you make, you decide how to architect it, right? Mm. And that doesn't mean that you're there today. That means in this business in 3 years from now or 5 years from now, does it tick all these boxes? And I may need to not have some of these boxes ticked as I'm going through the process, but do I get to a point where that's possible? Mm. And then always building towards the checkbox goal in the company. So decisions that are made is like, oh, do we spend the money to hire leadership early on, or do I do it all myself? Well, I can't go on vacation unless I hire leadership, so I've got to make the decision to hire leadership, right? And it just determines what those decisions are through that process. And maybe that is, you don't have the money to hire the leadership, then maybe I need to take on a couple of partners that are in addition to leadership, but to make sure that I set here's what I'm going to provide, here's what I'm responsible for, but in addition, I'm going to go on vacation this amount of times a year, because that's every year, that's time you can't get back. Like, you can't get those vacation days back, right? And some people are like, well, I'll just wait till 50 and I'll save them all up and I'm going to go on vacation all the time. But it's like, why not live your best life right now? You can. It's totally possible. You just have to architect it that way.
100%. We have something similar. We call it the rules of engagement in our software company, but that's more about the kind of products and people we want to serve. And actually, I really like that the yours is way more in terms of lifestyle and architecting the life, whereas I like that. Learning a lot. And so what I was going at with the dropshipping, so you said, right, this is a great model, but it's got some flaws. I need to evolve this. What, you know, so I'm going to do the hard work. I'm going to do the things that other people out there aren't willing to do or aren't able to do. What sort of things did you put into place in the sort of JSON dropshipping 3.0 model?
So, I mean, just in general, right? Like, so, you know, I'd been in so many spaces, just backing up a little bit on kind of the decision to get into the e-commerce world. One of the things in my checkbox is I want to do things that Facebook likes. Because I'd been battling Facebook for compliance and what they didn't like and this and that for so many years. I was just like, whatever I do next, Facebook, it's going to be something Facebook actually wants on their platform and is, you know, a win for them and a win for us. So I don't have to fight Facebook anymore. I can make them a partner. And we had a rep at Facebook at the time, and I went to him and he was like, well, you know, all the refi stuff you're doing, they don't like the data, this and that, that it gets distributed, and, you know, they're going to be shutting down refi, and they're going to be they don't like the long form VSLs, and it's all this stuff we don't like. And I'm like, what does Facebook like? And they're like, they like e-commerce. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Well, I'll build an e-commerce business, right? Like, literally, that's how the discussion happened. Well, I mean, I went and checked it against my boxes, and it ticked everything. And I was like, okay, well, that's what I'm going to do. I don't know anything about sourcing product or shipping product or customer service or compliance, or I don't know anything about any of this stuff, but I'll figure it out. And I built some other businesses and just had to figure it out. And I really enjoy that process. But I really looked at, it was primarily driven off of, okay, Facebook does not like dropshippers, right? They create a bad customer experience for the customer. They give them a package that looks like crap when it shows up. It shows up in 45 days. It pisses off a lot of people. So I was like, you know, that doesn't tick a bunch of my boxes. So I was like, but if I built my own brands, I manufacture the product, I give a good experience to the customer, I ship it to them in a quick fashion, they're happy, Facebook's happy.
I love that. Okay, so let's... Yeah, I lost you a little bit, but the sort of looking at, okay, well, I want to keep Facebook happy. What doesn't Facebook like? Okay, how can I solve those things? So, you know, improve the shipping time, improve the customer experience. And ultimately, it comes down to just value. I mean, you know, and actually, it's very simple in this world. Generally, like, you know, are you creating value or kind of taking it away, right? And drop shipping in many ways is often taking it away. And, you know, it's great because it's cheaper and so on. But yeah, if a customer has to wait a long time for that product, which may be a seasonal product, but if they have to wait a long time for that product and then it comes in a shitty package and stuff, they're going to complain. And Facebook, I know this from them directly, they get blamed a lot for it, right? Like,
right.
People are going on Scam Advisor and saying Facebook's a scam, you know, and it's right. Like, it's like, well, no, it's not, you know, but that was just what your first point of call. And so, you know, more people that improve it improves the industry as well, right? So, like, you know, people that have been scammed on a shitty site are unlikely to buy again. And I'm sure Jeff Bezos is like, yeah, come on, dropshippers, keep spoiling it, more people will come to me and my trusted network. But I'm so with you on that. So I'd like to change pace for a second and talk about Kosamui.
Okay,
I think I might have said it right for the first time. It's really hard for some reason. I don't want to say like mooey, which is like how I've been taught to say it, but that just seems wrong. Like a cow, like mooey.
Mooey.
Mooey. So what What initially? So obviously we're speaking because you know, we've got the honor of having you at our event, you know, and we've already discussed, you know, hanging out, sharing, you know, having a good work hard, play hard type entrepreneur vacation where we've got some absolute ballers sharing and giving in a great culture and a great environment.
Sure.
So what is it about this event that kind of ticked one of your boxes?
Yeah, it actually ticked it. I would never do something if it ticked one of my boxes. It's got to tick lots of boxes, number one. But ultimately, I mean, it goes back to that first forum that I was a part of, right? Like, it's all about relationships and networking in this space and, you know, getting a few ideas or having people to bounce things off of. And, you know, I saw an opportunity to, you know, it seems like you guys curate a great group of people, you know, to go build some real relationships with people that are doing things at a high level and inside of the business. So, you know, for me, that really was the most exciting thing, right? It's like, okay, I can go actually spend some time, because, you know, you go to a trade show and there's 1,000 people, and especially myself, and I hate to sound narcissistic, but, you know, being a speaker, being around so long, helping so many people over the years, like, a lot of times I'll wind up with a line of people that want to talk to me or ask me questions, by the way, which means a lot to me that somebody even wants to listen to what I want to have to say. So, you know, that's not a bad thing. You just don't get the time to really sit down and have longer discussions and roundtable discussions with people. One of my favorite things to do at this point in my life is go have a lunch with two or sometimes one person, sometimes three or four people or whatever, but really have no agenda, sit down and really just start talking about whatever. And there you are 4 hours later, and you've had a lot of deep discussions on stuff, and you've had an opportunity to really connect and, you know, learn some stuff and build that relationship with somebody. Like, I actually, that's like one of my favorite processes in life. Is your, you know, relatively no agenda. So that resonated with me with you guys when we were talking, and you're like, you know, it's not like a formalized speaking thing. You just got to come, and we talk in groups and discuss stuff. And, you know, we might ask you to talk on a topic, but it's kind of off the cuff, not prepared, organized, structured. And I was like, that is so up my alley, because that's what I love, right? Like, let's just go talk about stuff and have a roundtable discussion, or, you know, groups or breakouts or whatever, and also listen to other people talk on stuff and, you know, potentially learn new concepts and ideas. It just seems super exciting to me.
Absolutely. And it couldn't be further away from that sort of conference, slightly awkward handshake, name tag type environment. One of my favorite sessions from our event we did in January in Dominican Republic, we had like this swimming pool, and it had like a built-in bar right in the swimming pool.
Awesome.
And so we had, yep, the staff come out, and they're making pina coladas, right? No one had drunk any pina coladas by then, but everyone was like, yeah, like, I want a pina colada. So we're all drinking pina coladas. Right. We've got radio mic. We've got big outdoor speakers, and everybody's like, so we started off with a game of volleyball, and we're in and out of the pool, we're hanging out, we've got our cocktails, we're throwing things around, and then we go into a session. I think it was on alternative traffic sources, right? And so we're brainstorming about TikTok, we're brainstorming about sort of how you can scrape the destination sites, how we can siphon off blog traffic, how we can do all kinds of really fun stuff, right? But right, we're all sat around the pool, some are in the pool, some are out the pool. The ones out of the pool are only out of the pool because they had to grab something to take notes, right? That's the only, right, reason they've left the water. I think that session was hosted by Josh Elizetti. And so he sat actually on the pool bar, like surrounded by cocktails with the radio mic, giving his experience. And then we're passing the mic around. Everybody's like sharing, you know, and it was so much fun. We're enjoying the sun. I got so burnt. I hadn't prepped. I got so, my white skin was getting so, but we had, you know, we were sharing, and it was just so much fun, right? And it didn't feel like work, but that was probably one of the most highly rated sessions. And that's the kind of stuff we do. And it couldn't be further away from, you know, awkward, sweaty handshakes,
sure,
nodding along, you know, that thing. So it sounds like that. is you know, right up your street.
Yeah, well. I mean, again, it's about the relationship development and then getting deep into conversations, because, you know, you listen to a speaker on a stage and you get everything at surface level, but you got 800 other questions that are going to spawn another 1600 other questions. And it's the having the time and the space and the opportunity to allow those things to happen, which is, you know, which is great. That's what I'm excited about.
Amazing. All right. So at this point in the interview, typically what we do is we pivot a little bit and we go into the rapid fire question round, right? Which sounds sure. a bit like a game show. I ask the questions quickly. You can take as long as you want, and we may go off on a tangent, completely off piste, but we'll come back. We'll come back. So it's fine. Are you up for
no
that?
No problem. Yep, of course.
Are you two thumbs up for that? Yeah. It's a recent we'll thing it. I've started doing. I love it. Right. Okay, then. Go on.
I said easy peasy.
Easy peasy. Boom. Right. Okay. And you denied the option to view these questions beforehand. So everybody tuned in. This is, you know, spontaneous, right? Just like sure. we like it. So question number one, Jason, are there any unusual things you eat or drink regularly and why?
I don't know. I mean, I live in California, so, you know, probably the rest of the world thinks just our diets here as Californians are unusual. But, you know, I follow a fairly low calorie diet and find things that I enjoy eating that fit the profile. I think, you know, again, I'm a strategy person, right? So I have to go to strategy, and it's like, okay, well, I got to find something that I really enjoy and is under whatever calories for this meal. So maybe that's egg whites and sliced tomatoes, some avocado. I put hot sauce on everything, being a Californian. You know, so that's probably that. I mean, just my diet in general. You know, people call it intermittent fasting now. I call it being lazy. I drink black coffee in the morning. I really never eat anything until 12 o'clock. You know, at 12 o'clock, I eat... you know, I eat a lot of high protein, low carb stuff, and then, you know, typically really low calorie in the evening. You know, back in my 20s, you know, doing that same process, I'd be ripped and in great shape. Being 44 years old, it just keeps me not fat, not too fat. So
nice. I like that. How do you get yourself into a state of flow?
That's actually a tough one for me at this point in my career. You know, back when I worked for myself, and I didn't have employees and I didn't have teams and stuff like that, it was much easier for me, because I sat at my computer all day. I used to work 14, 17 hours a day writing code or, you know, solving a problem or whatever, and saying, okay, I want to accomplish this, and let me just brain dump the ideas. And then from the brain dump comes structure at some point. It's like, oh, well, that should be bundled with that, and that should go over there or whatever. Or if I'm writing, same thing. I just sit down and start writing words. So like, I love to get on an airplane and say, okay, I need to get 3 blog posts written. I'm not going to allow myself to turn on the TV or do anything else until these blog posts are written. Sometimes it takes me 5 minutes to get into a state of flow. And, you know, sometimes it takes me 2 hours, you know, and I'll sit there writing for 2 hours and none of it will feel right, and none of it feels messy and whatever, and then all of a sudden something will click and I'll get into that place. But, you know, I'm not diagnosed, but I believe I have ADD, and most people think ADD is the ability to not focus your attention, but it's really two extremes. It's either totally not focus and bouncing around and thinking about lots of things all the time, or it's 100% laser ultra focused, but there's no in the middle. I say I have a harder time, and I really don't get into a state of flow too much in this day and age, because a lot of my time is just meeting with employees, listening to their concerns, giving them feedback on the processes that they're doing. So it's a lot of like question and answer and feedback and stuff like that. Every once in a while, it's like, okay, this system's broken. I'll go put my, I'll think about it for a while. It typically takes me 1 to 2 days of kind of rolling it around in my head. If it's really complex, it might take me a week. And then at some point, I'll just sit down and anywhere from a 1 to 4 hour period, I'll build a whole system. Maybe it's 50 steps with measurements and KPIs. And then at some point, I'll never finish it. So I'll get it about 60%. I'll get all the strategy done. I'll get kind of the main points done and KPIs done. But then I need to hand it off to my operations team or person or whoever in order to take it over the finish line. Because I used to be like, well, I'll go back and finish it, and I know myself well enough now to know that will actually never happen. So.
Are you the kind of guy that if you were, say you were painting a wall in your house, you want to do the roller, the big coverage, and then the little sort of edging stuff that there's someone else?
Other way around. Yeah, I like to think of the edge cases. So from a programming perspective, you have edge cases. Mm-hmm. So the QA, the edge cases, thinking through where this is going to break, where it's not right. The bulk of the work... I get bored very easily. Anything that I have to do over and over again that's the same thing, I lose interest almost immediately. So I know I have to hand that day to day of that. That's why I'm a terrible manager. Like I'm probably one of the worst managers, because really management is about repeatability. It's about consistency. It's about timelines. So that's sitting down with employees, doing regular reviews, and I don't actually like, as I mentioned, why I'm excited about Costa Muy, I don't actually like structure myself. It's very, very good for employees and the company and the business. I myself, structure is my Achilles heel. I just am, it's not a strength of mine. And probably what is something that's very beneficial to me, but then doesn't allow me to be a good manager and some other things at the same time.
Interesting. What habit or opinion do you have that other people often disagree with?
Ooh, that's a good one. I guess it depends on where somebody is at in their career. I met with a guy that just graduated college. I had lunch with him yesterday. He's been an affiliate for a couple of years. And, he's like, well, my biggest opportunity to make money right now is to do this, to go build a business. And he's 22 years old. And, I had a discussion with him. So my belief system, as I said, work harder on yourself than you do in your business. Spend more time investing into growth and knowledge than you do chasing money, because money is really just a byproduct of being great. So, and being great is a byproduct of experiences. And, I tell people all the time, a force multiplier is something that impacts a large thing, right? So somebody that's a great manager is a force multiplier on a team. They make them more efficient, more effective. They make them make more money, right? That's a force multiplier as a concept. Well, wisdom and knowledge is a force multiplier on time. So we could do the exact same thing. I've got lots of wisdom and knowledge and have done it many times before. You know how to do it basically, but you're not an expert at it at this point. I could probably get a result in 5 minutes that it might take you 6 hours to produce. So knowledge and wisdom ultimately is a force multiplier on time. So I always encourage people to focus more on gaining knowledge and wisdom than I do on chasing money. And I think in our world, most people want to chase money. And so like I talked to this younger guy yesterday and I said, you're 22 years old. You obviously want to be an entrepreneur and you're at a point in your life where you could go work for some very great people over the next 3 to 5 years, and you could get some very, very valuable skills that when you really go full on becoming an entrepreneur, you're going to bring all that knowledge, wisdom, and experience to the table, as well as those relationships that you've built through those processes. And you know, he was like, yeah, but I'll make less money. And it's like, yeah, I understand that. And then he's like, well, maybe I'll make some money now and then I'll go do that later. And what I explained to him is later you have kids and a house and wife and family and obligations. And maybe now you have employees and you really can't do that later. Because if you start making a bunch of money right now, you're going to change your lifestyle. And your lifestyle is going to become more expensive. So you can't go take that lower paying job to go get that skill set. And the cost that it's going to cost you in order to acquire that business, that skill set in both time and money and making mistakes as an entrepreneur is going to be way more expensive than going and working for a great leader in the shorter term. And, you know, I think this is where, you know, the conflict comes. And I believe that's why I've been sustainable. That's why I've been as successful as I have, because my focus is on growth and learning more than it is on making money. And so, again, you know, if you have younger viewers, it's like, great, you've made some money, but go take this period of time to go work for a great leader, understand what it's like to work in a great organization that doesn't, and I always encourage everybody to work in a call center for at least 4 months to 6 months of their life, because you'll learn sales, you'll learn stuff so quickly, right? Because we gain skills through iterative experiences. So as long as we, you know, do it, experience it, self-reflect, improve, do it again, self-reflect, do it again, self-reflect, right? If you're going to work in a call center, you might do 100 calls a day. So you get really, really quickly, you get to learn how to sell, you get to learn how to deal with customers, you get to learn. And oftentimes people are like, well, I don't want to work in a call center. And it's like, you're not working in a call center because you're now a call center guy or a call center girl and you're that employee. You're going there to gain a skill set. And as long as it has an end, you're like, I'm just going to gain a skill set once. And their skills are hockey. They're hockey stick, right? They're really, really hard. Then you get this massive growth and then you know it pretty well. But to become an expert is going to take many years and you're not going to get the outcome that you're looking for. So, you know, I encourage people that are young to go take jobs doing a thing that they can learn. That's why I worked for Tony Robbins as a speaker. I was like, it's going to be very beneficial to learn to sell from a stage, to be able to speak, to be able to talk to a large group of people, to organize my thoughts effectively and efficiently. And so I took that experience to go, you know, to go learn that skill set. Was it the highest paying job I could get at the time? It wasn't. But it was going to give me way more skills than the high paying job where I was going to do the same thing over and over again and just make a lot more money. And I think that's, if I could tell anybody, and probably the one conflict is that go after the skills, don't go after the money.
I love that. If you ran a school but could only teach one non-traditional lesson, what would that be?
Yeah, I would teach a class on self-reflection. So looking inwards, you know, some people do it through journaling, some people do it through whatever. But I mean, there's, you know, self-reflection, the better questions you ask when you're self-reflecting, the more, the better answers you're going to get, and the more you're going to tap into your who you are, right? And, you know, I think a lot of people think about personal development or personal growth as I'm going to listen to podcasts and take notes, but really, that's just some good ideas. The real growth comes from implementing that thing and then that self-reflection period of time. And then just developing really, really strong questions and how to develop questions to ask yourself, like, okay, this is just another one that I'm a strong believer in. Great. So your business does $1 million a year. And most people set goals of, I want to do $1.5 million next year, right? Because we can, and typically you could probably get to that $1.5 million if you just work harder, right? Maybe one or two good decisions and you have to work harder. You know, a self-reflection question that I like is, okay, if I had to do $10 million in revenue next year, what would I do or how would I do it? And you can't work harder to get to $10 million. So this is actually going to tap into kind of your internal, like, okay, well, I couldn't do it. It's going to be your first opinion. Like, it's not possible. And then it's like, okay, well, if you were married and had kids and they were all going to starve and die if it didn't happen, what would have to happen for you to hit $10 million next year? And then it's like, okay, well, shoot, if I had to do that, and then you really start to get into that self-reflection period of time. You know, another thing is, you know, a lot of times we're hard on ourselves. We make bad decisions or we hire the wrong person. And, you know, we're hard on ourselves and, oh, now I'm not going to hire people anymore because that, or I'm, you know, whatever. I tried to hire a leader and they sucked and, you know, all leaders suck now, right? And, you know, it's really taking, in tech, they call it a postmortem. You know, after you do a release and it doesn't go well, or it does go well, you do a postmortem and you say, what went well? What did I not see in the beginning? What did I not plan for? And you constantly iterate through this process. And, you know, for us, we need to do this personally on a daily basis. You know, at the end of your workday, like, what is the one piece of value or system I created in the business that's going to pay dividends over the next 5 years? Like, ask yourself that question every day for 30 days. And all of a sudden, every day you will come into work and you will do one thing from here until forever that's actually going to pay dividends down the road. Oftentimes we come to work and we put out fires and we just do work, right? This doing an interview is just doing work. And this is great. I mean, it's
creating actually, you're setting me on fire right now. So it doesn't feel like work right now. It feels like a very, very quick learning curve of wisdom.
Well, what's the one thing you're going to do today that will make your life easier for the next foreseeable future days, right? That's a really interesting question, because then you're looking at, how am I creating a better system? How am I creating, you know, and maybe that's, I'm going to go put a job description up and hire somebody that can take on this piece of this role. And, oh, by the way, you know, I need to create some kind of a system for them to follow. And now that piece will be with you forever. Mm. Right. So it's that time that you invest into the thing that will pay dividends down the road is so valuable.
So is there any way, because this is absolute gold, and I want to read the Jason's book of, you know, self questions,
sure.
which may not exist yet. Is this out there in the ether anywhere at the moment?
It is not. It is not.
We need to make that happen somehow.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely can put it down. You know, one thing I've been considering doing, and I mean, it obviously helps my personal brand. It helps the company brand and whatnot, but, you know, I really do enjoy giving back. You know, I'm not sitting here telling you how to tricks to run Facebook campaigns. That doesn't mean I don't know them, you know, is repeatable. Even if Facebook changes, you know, what are the systems that we're putting into place, or what are the systems that we're putting in place to create the systems that take that stuff into account? You know, most of my time goes there. But what I was saying is, I actually have been thinking about, you know, maybe working with somebody to do interview questions like this, that'll take content like this and actually, you know, ghostwrite it for me into my blog. I just don't have the time to
You know, found the right person, man. We can talk off air, and I can tell you how my latest book was actually, I didn't write a single word. It's 300 pages. I didn't write a single word.
I love it. So I've got lots of good stuff, lots of good principles, lots of concepts and ideas on teams and how to run companies and measurements and how to, you know, every single thing involved in that. It's just getting it out of here onto a page. You know, it's like, you know, where do I find the time to break away from, you know, building this company, but also getting my vacation to, so something has to suffer ultimately.
Ugh. Look forward to getting into that with you. What book or books had the biggest impact on your life?
Ah, love this question. Yeah. Different books at different points in time. When I first got into marketing, Cashvertising was my Bible. I probably read it 30 times. You know, there's other great books out there, Gary Halbert and stuff like that. But you know, I'm part of the short attention span theater. So, you know, Cashvertising, I think it's 150 pages or something. They compress Cialdini's influences. They, you know, they take a lot of Gary Halbert stuff. They like Dan Kennedy stuff. And he really compresses it into such good information. So, you know, again, that was back 2005, I was 2007, something like that. I was reading that book, and I actually found it in Barnes & Noble and then kind of worked on proliferating it through the industry because I think it is such a great book, written by a guy named Drew Whitman, who's been a speaker at Affiliate Summit and Affiliate World and stuff. But most recently, my favorite book I've read is called Scaling Up, and it's by, I think, Verne Harnish.
Yeah.
I've now read that book three times. I think it is the very best book that I've ever read on so many levels for building and scaling a business and an enterprise. That is, you know, great, I want to run affiliate ads, or I want to do e-commerce and figure out how to build ads and make a little money. You know, Cashvertising is great for that. Oh gosh, what's the other one? With the green cover with the arrow on it for the e-commerce stuff. That's a good book for that. Gosh, can't remember the guy's name right now. But also .com Secrets, I think, is a great book, you know, on the marketing side. So, what is it? E-commerce Evolved. That's what the other one is.
That's I forget. I know the book.
Good book as well. And again, macro concepts, you know, if you've been doing this for many years and, you know, but I read E-commerce Evolved and I got a couple of good ideas out of it. But again, you know, that's on the marketing side. On the business side, Scaling Up is so good on so many levels. It just tells you, you know, how to approach a market, how to build a team culture. And again, it's probably synthesizing thousands of books, taking the best ideas and then putting them into 250 pages. It's pretty heavy. So I'll often listen to it, keep a printed book in front of me with a highlighter and then a way to take notes, and I'll get through 2 to 3 pages in a day. And, you know, there's so much meat that, and there's so much to process if you do the self-reflection time. He talks about something, I'll read it again, I'll think about it, I'll think about how it potentially applies to my business, how it's doing well or not doing well in my business for that thing, potentially what I could change to make it more efficient or effective using that principle, and then I'll go on to the next. But it's almost like a college course. Self-directed college course. And I really, really love that book. And if you want to build a large scalable business, it's a must read as far as I'm concerned.
And that's Cashvertising.
Scaling up.
Yeah. I remember that's like a manual, isn't it? It's not calling it a book is almost a disservice. It's like an actual manual, a textbook. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
What does the first 30 to 60 minutes of your day look like? And at what time do you get up?
Sure. I used to stay up till 2 to 4 in the morning programming or working on stuff and whatever. And then I've got a 10-year-old boy and a 9-year-old boy now. And so about 10 years ago, they decided they wanted to get up at 5:30 in the morning every morning. And so they would come in and I'd go to bed at 4 and they'd come in at 5:30 and they didn't go away. So, you know, over the years, you know, I typically go to bed about 10 o'clock at night. And then I wake up around 5:30 to 6:30-ish. Typically lay in bed for an hour to 2 hours in the morning. I have a cup of black coffee. You know, probably the first 10 minutes is not just nothing. I'm just sitting there kind of thinking about the day and, you know, kind of what I'm going to do today and what I hope to accomplish. And then, you know, I like to read the news. I read international news a lot. So, you know, international policy, international finance, so, you know, market trends, macro market trends, macroeconomic stuff is interesting to me. So I read like economists and follow their stuff. I read Digiday, which is the biggest advertising publication for, you know, large scale media buying stuff, like in the agency world, you know, and I read stuff like that. And then oftentimes, you know, spend some time, a little time with my boys, but I'll actually get up around 7:30 to 8 o'clock often. And then, 3 days a week, I go to the gym at 7:30 to 8:30. I have a trainer and have for 7 years. So that's Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And then I go to the office at 8:30. And then I'm always in the office by 8:30 or 9 o'clock every morning when I'm home, obviously.
Go ahead. I was gonna say, sorry, I didn't mean to get... I'm curious, how does the black coffee make it to its way into the bed? Like, do you get out of bed, make the coffee, and get back into bed? Or is there some sort of...
No, my wonderful wife typically goes down and makes me a cup of coffee and brings it up and puts it on the nightstand for me.
Oh wow, that's magical. That's well trained. My wife receives that every morning from me, but it doesn't happen the other way around often. Any advice for your previous boss or bosses in general?
I didn't have a lot of great bosses. You know, Tony Robbins, I had some good bosses. They were great communicators in a one-way conversation. So they were great at training and speaking and stuff like that, but they weren't often great at listening and really hearing and connecting. You know, when I sold franchises, you know, I was young, looking at stuff. Like, I have lots of recommendations. I don't have any bosses that were like, oh wow, they were amazing, and if they did this one other thing, they'd be even more amazing. You know, just appreciate your people. Look, you know, understand what their goals are and their ambitions are. I think is super important. Like, you know, where do they want to be in 2 years? And oftentimes they're not thinking about this, so challenging them to think about it, like, you know, where do you want to be in 2 years, or what role do you want to have in the organization? I mean, none of my bosses ever did that. You know, I always had very big ambitions, and I think they could have got a lot more out of me if they spent the time to understand who I was and kind of what my goals and ambitions were, and, you know, then, you know, put systems and processes in place in order to facilitate that stuff getting done. But I think most bosses just, whatever, you come to work and just do this job and go home, and, you know, we're going to pay you enough to not leave, and, you know, whatever, you know, that's just kind of the process. Mentorship, coaching, I think the more bosses can become mentors and coaches, and the more you'll retain employees, and the more people will appreciate you, even when they leave the company.
Like that. Where do you go, or what do you do to get inspired?
I mean, I'm sure I'll come back inspired from, you know, Koh Samui when we're there. You know, I vacation a lot, as I said. I try and vacation 100, 120 days a year. Typically, I'm with people on those vacations. Sometimes it's with family, but a lot of times it's with people that do similar businesses or different businesses, you know, and just kind of hearing how their businesses work. I really love understanding businesses outside of our space because, again, for me, I love abstraction and strategy. So, you know, when you look at a chemical business in the EU and we're a marketing business in the US, it's not what's different, but rather what's the same. And then understanding, because it's all those things that are the same, which is where I want to put my effort, because then they're going to be the same for any business and help any business scale. So, you know, just being around people that are self-reflective is super inspirational for me. Like, you know, hey, I'm thinking about this, or I'm going through this process, or I had this struggle, or, you know, I love to listen to speakers that, you know, so many speakers out there are speakers, but I love talking to people or listening to speakers that had experiences. So, you know, like actually did the thing, didn't talk mm-hmm. about doing the thing, but actually went through the process of personal development and came out the other side and, you know, were self-reflective about it. And are like, that stuff's amazing to me. I really love that. I don't really listen to it much anymore, but obviously Tony Robbins' stuff back in the day was hugely impactful for me. Jim Rohn was his mentor. And honestly, I actually like Jim Rohn's stuff better than I like Tony's stuff. And so I'll go back and listen to that from time to time. Reading books. I mean, there's just so many places to find inspiration, right? And a new thing to test, a new thing to try, a new thing to roll out. Sometimes I get inspiration from hiring great employees. You know, you hire somebody in that knows a lot more than you about something, and wow, that's an amazing opportunity to learn, right? And to grow. And oh, wow, I'm going to learn all this stuff because this person has all this experience, and, you know, really being humble and being like, I don't know how this stuff works. And sure, I'm the boss and, you know, I know all this other stuff and whatever, but I don't know anything about this. So I'm your student, right? And being humble to that. So inspiration, I think, really comes just from so many places in life. And so, you know, even it can be as simple as you walk into a store and see a product and you're like, oh, that's super cool, you know, and here's some iterations on that product and we could potentially sell that. And it just comes from everywhere, you know, ultimately, for me at least.
Love that. If I gave you $5,000, how would you double it in 24 hours?
Ooh, wow. I mean, what's the risk, right? Because you're asking about a return and you can't ask for a return without risk, right? So, I mean, the easy answer is I'm going to go play one hand of blackjack, and if I win, I'm going to double it. And if I lose, I'm going to wind up with nothing, you know? So, you know, that's a 50% odds risk. So, you know, anytime I'm looking at analyzing anything, it's what is the risk ratio? If I have to double it and I have to make money, in 24 hours. Whew, that's a good question. I don't have an answer. I'm not that guy, right? I don't look at things that way.
That's super interesting to me, though, that you went straight to the risk thing. And obviously, you know, the majority of these questions, some of these questions, it's not about the actual what you do. It's the process that got you to that. And so, you know, it's interesting to me that, you know, it's like the risk profile. How important is it? And then figuring out the strategy afterwards,
right.
You know, comes secondary. So that's still, you've answered that. Next up, what's the best advice ever given to you?
I'd go to Jim Rohn and, you know, work harder on yourself than you do in your business. You know, that's something that has stuck with me and really is a guiding principle in my life. Our number one value on our values board inside of A4D says our number one value is always be learning and growing. And, you know, that's my guiding light. And I think as long as you work on your skill set and become better every day, and, you know, when you kind of peaked at a thing or you've got to the top of that hockey stick, go take on a new challenge. That's, I call it jumping in the deep end of the pool and not knowing how to swim. And because that's where you're going to get that's where you're going to reset that hockey stick again. And I'm always trying to live into a place where I'm somewhere between here and the top of the hockey stick. And as soon as I get to the top, I'm like, I'm good. I don't need to do that thing anymore. I don't need to progress on that skill because I'm 80% of the way to being a master. I can go hire somebody that's a master for me, but I understand how they do and can talk to them and the impacts and how this is a operational tool inside of whatever I want to build moving forward.
Powerful. What silly thing should people do more of?
Listen to strangers or listen to people you don't know. Like, you know, I think most people go into conversations with I don't know if it's silly or not, but you know, go into conversations with an outcome, you know, listen just to people. And, you know, obviously you find out fairly quickly whether that person is self-reflective and has value or not. You know, and then at the same time, like understanding, you know, none of these are silly, right? Like, I'm a very purpose-driven person. So try, you know, if you had kids, get down and play with their toys, play with them, get down on their level, be a kid. You know, that's probably what I would equate to silliness, right? Go to the trampoline park and jump on the trampolines with them, you know, go to the water slide park and go on the water slides with them or whatever it might be, right? And participate.
That reminds me of an answer from a similarly awesome guy who said something very, very similar. He said basically, there's a good chance that if you play with the toys that you used to play with as a kid, you'll still enjoy it. Right, and you still get it out. So
do Legos that. Are amazing. I love building Legos with the kids. I mean, that's just I used to love them when I was a kid, and I still love buying them and building stuff with them. I mean, it's amazing.
On that note, the thing that I'm still learning is when I've built an absolute masterpiece and my 18-month-old comes over to destroy it, I'm still sort of, you know, getting over the sadness that comes from seeing the masterpiece and then remembering this isn't your toy, Martin, this is his toy, you know, that sort of thing. When he comes and just completely bulldozes it.
I mean, that was the FTC for me in real life, right?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
I mean, they basically came through and bulldozed everything I had built. So, you know, everything in life, you know, I think I was talking to some people about this the other day. It's like, oh, that's a painful experience. And it's like, yes, and feel that pain and live that pain and appreciate it and then learn from it. Right. And it's those opportunities. I mean, that was one of the most pivotal points in my life that said, OK, I'm running a pirate ship. And it's not structurally sound and it's not efficient and there's not great systems and there's not a great culture to actually building real businesses that do have all that stuff. And it's really that FTC case and that suit that was the trigger that forced me to make that decision and forced me to build a company with value and forced all that stuff. So you can look at the FTC as a very negative light and, oh my gosh, that was terrible. And I can't believe that happened and I'm a bad person and whatever else you want to feel about that thing. And of course you go through all of those emotions, but it's really looking back on it. It was instrumental in who I am today.
Yeah. You either win or you learn or both. Would you rather fight one horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses?
Horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses? I think I would go with the horse-sized duck.
Why?
I mean, it's like smashing ants, right? Like, how do you got all these horses coming at you and how do you get them all at the same time, where, you know, you could have a David and Goliath type situation where, you know, it's one jugular blow to, if you wanted to kill that horse-sized duck and or tame that horse-sized duck and ride it and show it to everybody, right? Like, hey, look at my horse-sized duck. Nobody else has one of these, right? So it just seems more manageable. I'm a focus-driven person, and I can solve that problem more easily than I can solve how am I going to handle 100 of something. So I just naturally always go to the more simplistic thing. No matter how big it is, that doesn't matter. It's just if I can just focus on solving this one problem, you know, it's more efficient and, you know, probably would get to a better outcome quicker.
I like that. How would you convince someone to do something good that they didn't want to do?
It's about everything in life is a pain pleasure ratio, right? So Tony Robbins talks about this a lot, right? It's like, oh, I need to do this thing, but the pain of actually maybe going to the gym, right? I need to lose weight, but the pain of going to the gym is greater than the pleasure of being skinny. And, you know, so that you've got this, and you're like, okay, I need to go to the gym. I need to, and people tell themselves this for years. Now you go to the doctor and it's like, oh, by the way, you've got 6 months to live. If you don't correct your diet and you don't get exercise, now the pain just became so great for not exercising that the only option if you want to live is to go exercise. So all of a sudden the pain of exercising is lower than the pain of I'm going to die, right? Mm-hmm. And I use that as an extreme example, but this is effectively everything in life. So if somebody doesn't want to do something, you need to understand why they don't want to do it, why it's more painful to do that thing, and then you need to build enough beneficial reasons that the pleasure for doing that thing is greater than the pain of doing it. So just from an abstract standpoint, you know, that, you know, that's how I process that question, right? It's like, oh, I don't want to do that thing. And it's like, well, you know, here's what it's going to do for everybody in the company, and here's what it's going to do for you, and here's what it's going to do for your career, and here's what it's going to do for whatever. And you have to build up enough reasons why that's all greater than the actual work and pain that's going to go involved in the process.
That might be my favorite answer to that particular question right there. And then the final question, Jason, and you've been amazing. The final question is in many ways the most important question.
Yes.
What makes you the happiest?
The ability to do whatever I want to do.
Freedom.
It really comes down to that, right? Like, there's actually a few things. I love being able to go into any conversation and have great answers and have a great dialogue with anybody in the world. I mean, that makes me super happy. Like I said, I really love sitting and like with whoever it is or whoever that's at a certain level and just talking shop and having people going away from that conversation going, wow, that was extraordinarily valuable. Like that person knows their shit. Like that makes me super happy. But then freedom, you know, that ultimately leads at its core, it's freedom, right? It's if I want to go on vacation with my kids, I can. You know, people, this is a misnomer in our business, especially on the affiliate side. People talk about a lifestyle business that in the affiliate world and a lot of other worlds is, oh, I can travel around and I can do my work. I'm doing the work wherever I am. To me, that is not a lifestyle business. If you build a great organization, that great organization throws off profits and cash flow, and you don't have to be there in order to run that organization on a day-to-day basis. To me, that's ultimately a lifestyle business because I can go do whatever I want at any time I want, and I can spend time with my kids. I can go on vacation with my wife. If you're like, hey, you want to come to Costa Mui? I'm like, sure, I can go to Costa Mui. I'm not tied to, and I can really be present. Right. Because if I was a lifestyle business where I did all the work, I'd have to be with you guys. But I'm thinking about all the work that I have to go do as soon as I'm done. OK, I need to go put in 4 hours to get my campaigns going or to do the thing. So it's that ultimate freedom that allows me to be present, have those conversations and spend time and be present with anybody that I'm with at any point in time without thinking I've got to go do this thing.
I love that. And so you mentioned Costa Mui. What would you say to someone who's watching this and or not watching this, but they're on the fence about whether to come or not?
Any time in your life that you're looking for any kind of answers, you know, it's about putting yourself in situations where those answers can allow themselves to show up. And, you know, maybe you're built a really big drop shipping business and you want to migrate and, you know, you've had enough pain. in the drop shipping business that you want to migrate to a brand business and building product lines, or maybe you are, you know, you've done really well with you and a partner, and you're doing $10 million a year with you and a partner, but now you want to build a real organization. It's about building those relationships with people that have already done that. And, you know, that time spent with finding those people and spending time with those people is way more valuable than sitting in your business turning the crank, because that's only going to allow you to make maybe that 10% growth or 20% growth over the next year. To go from, as we were saying earlier, to go from that million to 10 million, those ideas are going to come from outside of what's in your head and asking yourself those self-reflective questions that maybe you don't know the answer to, but then you can go spend time to get the answers from another group of people or a person to answer those questions for you. In addition to that, I'm a strong advocate of what Ray Dalio calls triangulation. Okay, I want to go on this direction. Let me go talk to the three smartest people that I know that do this thing. Let me get all their opinions. Then I'm going to take all those opinions. I'm going to synthesize that information down, and I'm going to build a plan for me to go forward with. I think small groups like this, where there's intimate time to talk and really self-reflect and stuff, is a great place to find triangulation for whatever ideas or wherever you're stuck in your business, and then how to go forward. And that self-reflection time and that growth time is really the most important, because turning the crank is just going to get you a little bit further. That other stuff is what's going to make the business grow in leaps and bounds.
Phenomenal. Jason, the wisdom that has been unleashed on this call, the experience, the knowledge, the strategies, that's all been delivered in such a humble, succinct way. I'm so grateful that you've taken the time to share with us. So gratified that, you know, that you're here and you're doing that, and that you're going to be, you know, with us in Koh Samui and, you know, hanging out. I cannot wait. And
sounds fun.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you guys inviting me. And like I said, it's always, it means a lot to me when people say, hey, I want you to be at this thing, or I want to hear what you have to say. So, you know, it always makes me feel good. And I love to give back, and I love to listen. I love to share with people that want to hear, and I'm excited to learn as well. So.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Hey, Martin here again with an audio goodie bag of a bonus before you head off. First up, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, please subscribe and follow Smarter Destiny across iTunes, YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. It really helps spread our message, and you'll get valuable content along the way too. Secondly, if you have an e-commerce business or are thinking of starting one, grab a copy of my new book, 1% Secret, recommended by Kevin Harrington and a host of other elite guys. Even better, it's free. Just help out with the shipping cost. So head to smarterdestiny.com/book to grab your free copy. Thanks so much, and I'll see you on the next episode.